Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for the 17th of July 2013. Joining me for this edition of the AV Forums podcast are AV Forums assistant editor Steve Withers.
Evacuating our moment of triumph.
Movies editor Simon Crust.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
Games editor Mark Botwright.
Doors to manual cross-check Phil.
Games podcast presenter Steve Hill.
Apocalypse cancelled.
And news editor Mark Hodgkinson.
I'll take a pee please, Bob.
And we're back yet again for another hot podcast. Yes, thanks very much for downloading and listening. Apple now say we are hot on iTunes, and also top three in the tech podcast downloads. So thank you very much for that. And it's also hot in other ways because of the weather. We are suffering a heat wave if you're listening outside the UK. Guys, we're all geeks, we're all freaks, we've all got loads of equipment around us, and I bet it's all switched on and we're absolutely boiling.
Not yep. Really, no.
Well, it is now. You made me turn my fan off.
Some of us don't have any choice. We've got multiple review samples.
Oh, my iMac doesn't put out much heat at all.
Oh, yeah. Just works.
That thing I sent you though, Mark. That
it's pretty warm. I have to say, you have to sit.
You could cook up that thing.
Oh, that laptop. Yeah, that's the one. I'm
sitting six spaces back. Yeah, I've got a lot of arms.
Guys, plasma TVs, good idea in this weather or not, Simon?
Well, summer isn't always the best time for critical viewing because it gets dark so late in the evening. I don't have a dedicated room like some of you guys here, but I do have blackout blinds, and it just seems such a shame to shut out the light and the heat. So but see, that Kuro, it does kick out a lot of heat. It does kick out a lot of heat. And the last couple of nights I watched have I seen The Devil or the Devil in Me or something, I can't remember the name of the film, some Korean horror thing, and that was so hot. It was so hot.
Nice to see the movies editor takes a lot of pride in what he's watching at the minute. Steve Hill, you edit videos for a living, surrounded by monitors and PCs. I bet you're frying.
Yeah, the office gets really warm. Got lots of RAID arrays and 30-inch monitors here, so it does get nice and toasty. Don't even need the radiator in the winter, so as you can imagine, I am sweltering right now. But, you know, it's a small price to pay for the nice weather.
And Mr. Botwright, how do you keep cool?
Well, I think you've got to just plow through it, aim a fan at your head, and I've just been trying to get through Skyrim, finish that off before the next gen, and so playing through some of the more Arctic regions helps keep you in a cool frame of mind.
And Hodge, how do you keep cool?
A lot of windows open and wearing less clothes than is probably decent.
Oh, no, there's a thought.
Ah, sorry.
Not really.
There's no other way.
This is a video podcast.
Well, yeah. I was trying to keep quiet the fact I'm just sitting in a pair of shorts as well. Nothing else.
Ah, oh, no!
There's a nice image for you all. Right. So I know it's not one of us said that we switch the stuff off and let the rooms cool down. So that's nice to see that we are total geeks there. So obviously in hot weather like this, the best place to be is probably a well air-conditioned cinema. So Mr. Withers, what's at the cinema?
Yes, I'm a big fan of going into a pitch black cinema on a really hot sunny day. And last Friday, I went to go and see Pacific Rim, which is Guillermo del Toro's new movie. Big fan of Del Toro. I think he's one of the most talented filmmakers working today. He's got a wonderful imagination. He places a lot of emphasis on using real, you know, practical effects wherever possible, doing things in camera if you can, which I really appreciate because it means his stuff isn't just, you know, CG fest, although there is an awful lot of CG in Pacific Rim. You've probably seen the trailers for it. It's not been an easy film to market, I suspect, because, you know, it basically is about giant robots fighting giant monsters. And there aren't any massive stars. I mean, there's Idris Elba and Charlie Hunnam, but I wouldn't call them household names, even though they're both very good actors. So they've had to use the robots and the monsters part as the main sort of thrust of the marketing, which is a shame in a way, because as you'd expect from Del Toro, he does manage to invest quite a bit of emotion into the movie. I mean, the thing about the robots are that they are actually controlled by people inside them, two people, in fact. One person isn't capable of handling a robot on their own, so they have to have two controllers, and they go through a thing called the drift, which means that they sort of meld their minds and share the same emotions and memories. So it gives it a great deal of emotional resonance. So when they are fighting, you know, if a robot loses an arm, it affects the people inside as well. It makes it much more, it's not like watching Transformers where, you know, you've just got two robots beating the hell out of each other for half an hour and you're bored, stiff and couldn't care less. This you actually are emotionally invested in, which is a good thing. It's absolutely, so I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a cracking movie. Very well made. The effects were absolutely superb. I mean, he did as much as he could in terms of practical effects. But obviously, when you're talking about giant robots, that's the CG. But the two are seamlessly integrated, so you really don't notice it. You know, when they go from either something practical to something that's purely CG, it's absolutely gorgeous to look at. It's pure eye candy. It's very exciting. It's funny in places. My only complaint would be there's a sort of a comedy duo of scientists, one of whom's Bern Gorman, who used to be in Torchwood, who is bloody awful. The other guy looks just like J.J. Abrams, which is kind of weird. For a moment, I thought it was J.J. Abrams. But Del Toro regular, forgot his name.
Ron Perlman.
Thank you. Del Toro regular
that's
Ron
Perlman. That's a little spoiler, isn't it?
No, he's in the trailer. I don't think that's a spoiler.
I don't think it really surprised me when he came on. I thought it was a really, really nice moment. I didn't realise he was in the movie at all. So
I would have been surprised if he wasn't in the film, given that he's done most of Del Toro's, or at least all of his English language movies, and he was in Kronos as well, which was obviously...
Well, I think he's the link to Charlie Hunnam, isn't he? From
They're both in Sons of Anarchy. So
Yeah.
He pops up, quite a small part though, so I thought it actually would be a bigger role. But it's a very enjoyable movie. It's very well made. It's got a good cast. Idris Elba's always great. Gets to go a really great speech, sort of two-thirds of the way through, which I think you alluded to at the beginning, Steve, about Apocalypse Cancelled.
He's my tip for the next Bond. Yeah, I saw it. Yeah, I loved it. I really enjoyed it, which is funny because I hated the trailer. Like, I really can't tell you how much I hated the trailer, and it was just nice to go and see a movie where I didn't see the Pacific Rim trailer. So
I just wish it wasn't called Pacific Rim. Maybe Pacific Rift, I think, would have been a better title. Rim just got certain connotations to me. I think that's
Charlie Hunnam's big break came in.
Queer
as Folk. So yeah, it's a little link there for you.
But I did enjoy watching Hong Kong get a good trashing because I used to live there and I could recognise buildings.
Oh,
that
bloody hell! Here we go again. I used to live there.
It's one time at band camp.
That's what it's like. Every bloody podcast has to mention he lived in Asia. Anyway, this looks like it's going to be a flop, though. Even given the good feedback.
Really.
It only made $38 million over the weekend in the US, which frankly is not enough on a $190 million budget. It's probably going to make about $120 million in the US. They've got to cross their fingers and hope that things like having Rinko Kikuchi in it is going to make a big difference in Asia. I think in Asia it probably will sell well because there's a whole tradition of kaiju, which is what they call the monsters in the film. I mean, it's Japanese for, monster, basically. They've got a whole tradition in Japan of things like Godzilla, so monster movies, so kaiju. The robots are called Jaegers for some reason, which is obviously German for hunter. The only Jaeger I know is a Jaeger bomb. But they have to hope that, keep their fingers crossed and hope that it does well elsewhere because it's not going to make enough money in the US, which is a shame because this is Del Toro's first serious big budget studio movie. And it's really good.
Wouldn't you say, Steve, that I think one of the nicest things I can say about this movie is it doesn't feel like Hollywood. I mean, it has all the production values, but it feels just somewhere in between. It's not foreign cinema. It's not big budget Hollywood. It's just its kind of own little thing. I thought that was a really nice thing about it.
Even though it is a big budget Warner picture, their sort of tentpole movie for the summer apart from Man of Steel, it felt like a Del Toro movie still. And I think that's just a testament to his abilities as a filmmaker and the fact that also it had a largely British cast, actually. I think it must have been shot. You can always assume whenever almost everyone is British that it was shot in somewhere like Canada rather than the US. My big concern was it going to just be big robots and big monsters get really boring? Because, I mean, if you've seen Man of Steel, the last 40 minutes is mind-numbingly boring.
Oh, my God,
indestructible superhero, or supervillain and superhero, beating the hell out of one another. When you're sitting in the cinema getting concerned about the level of collateral damage in the film and how people are getting killed, you know, in the buildings that are being destroyed, that's not a good sign. When you start worrying about collateral damage. But I didn't worry about that in Pacific Rim. I just thought, come on, let's go for it.
What time of day did you go to see it, just out of interest?
and 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, was it full of school kids? Because when I went about five.
It was quite busy though for a 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a sunny day.
It was full of school kids in my screen, all 14-year-olds. I think if I was 14 seeing that movie, I think it was the best thing I'd ever seen, and they were loving it.
Del Toro said he made it for the 14-year-old in himself, and he succeeded admirably, in my opinion. If I'd been 14, I'd have absolutely creamed myself watching that movie.
Did they show the Gravity trailer before it as well?
Yeah, that looked really good.
Right, the whole cinema. Imagine all these 14-year-old kids sort of, you know, being a bit leery and loud. When that trailer came on, they were in stunned silence for about a minute after. All of them just stopped dead in their tracks. I know we're talking about Pacific Rim, but I'm so excited for that movie. It looks amazing.
So did anybody else manage to see this?
Yep.
Speak up.
I'm a little bit scared after that kind of long soliloquy, but I'm going to have to be the voice of doubt about this film. Honestly.
No, really? The voice of doubt? You?
Well, this seemed right up my street.
Yeah, I would say it's the whole Japanese thing. You love all that.
Kaiju films, and it's got a little bit of kind of Neon Genesis Evangelion about it with the kind of neural link. It seemed perfectly set for me to absolutely love it. But I found it a slog. I'll be honest, I did. It's so much a kind of early teen film that I can see the bombast there. But one of my big problems with it was so much of it, because it's obviously Pacific Rim and these things come through the ocean. For a monster movie, for a kaiju film, you need a sense of scale. You want buildings there. Virtually all the big fight scenes are underwater, in semi-water, or at night. You know, it's only like flashbacks that you actually get to see a proper city kind of half get leveled. And then it's only kind of snapshots. There's no great sense of scale to it. I just didn't feel that.
But don't you think then it would have run the risk
of... in Hong Kong. What are you talking about?
And what time was that at? Was that during the day? Did you see much of the actual landscape about
it? But there's a reason why they did it at night, because Hong Kong looks really cool at night because of all the neon and the buildings and stuff.
Oh, yeah. All I'm saying is that it did seem quite... I don't know. It just...
You're right, though. There was a lot of stuff happened in water, and I was wondering what exactly they were standing on, because also there's a monster in it that sets off an electromagnetic pulse at one point, and two of the robots obviously get brought down by it because they can't operate, you know, because their electronics are all broken. But then they go, "Oh, don't worry, we've got Gypsy Danger. That's analog. It's got a nuclear reactor. Analog? What, is it run by string bullies then, is it? No, I'm pretty sure it had electronics in it somewhere." Yeah, that was ludicrous. But
I think you kind of got to leave a lot of your cerebral matter at the door, haven't you, really, to enjoy it. But I don't really have a problem with a popcorn movie in that style.
I've got no problem with popcorn movies like that. I just, honestly, I went in there thinking that it was going to be more about the kind of giant robots. But like with kind of a lot of Del Toro's films, the effects tend to lean towards the organic. I just felt like the monsters were better realized than, you know, you don't really find out anything about these kind of giant mechs other than they've got, you know, stereotypical nationalities piloting them or anything like that. And it's only at the end of the film that, well, in fact, I can't even say that bit. That'd be a massive spoiler. But it annoyed me that they find another weapon that they've forgotten that they had for 90 minutes, a weapon that, shock horror, actually seems to do some kind of damage. They've got this kind of plasma cannon that you'd need the slow reactions of a kind of Sunday league pub player to actually get hit by. And then at the very end, they seem to find another weapon that actually does more damage, and they've completely forgotten about it. It was like kind of RoboCop forgetting that his gun was in his leg or something.
Yeah, but that's like Lex in Jurassic Park, and it's Linux, I know this.
No, it's not as bad as an Independence Day where they could connect their computer with Windows software onto an alien spaceship.
Well, no, it was actually an Apple Mac. It was a Mac.
Was it an Apple Mac they were using?
Yeah, it was a Mac.
I have a question.
Yeah. Go on. I have a question for all those who've seen it. 3D or 2D? Okay.
I deliberately watched it in 2D.
I don't see films in 3D.
Yeah, I saw it in 2D as well.
Interesting.
Because... obviously, about 9 months ago, there was a big uproar when Warner's decided they wanted to release it in a post-converted 3D version. And Del Toro was against that initially, although he did renege later. Because his argument, and it's a valid argument, which is that, you know, if you hyper-stereo-wise large things, they look small. And the whole point was that these meant to look like giant robots. And so for that reason alone, I decided, no, I don't want to see it in 3D. I want to see it in 2D. Now, to be fair, most of the effects... all the big effect sequences, obviously your CG, and they were done completely in 3D from scratch. So I'm sure it probably would look quite good in 3D, and I'm sure Del Toro knows what he's doing and can make it effective, but I just felt that I would prefer to watch it. I don't like watching conversions anyway. And since he didn't want to do that and he didn't shoot it with that in mind, I decided I'd rather watch it in 2D.
The reason I ask is because Kaz reviewed it and he raved about how good. I mean, he went to see it IMAX 3D, which is obviously slightly different from a standard showing, but he raved about it. He said it was a brilliant experience. And it's interesting. I'm going to go and sit tomorrow, but I'm going to go and sit in 2D because I'm kind of 3D'd out. But it's interesting that all of us here have gone to see a 2D version.
Well, actually, the breakdown of 2D against 3D viewing numbers, you know, ticket sales in the States at least, has been 50-50. And that's the highest ratio for 3D ticket sales of any film so far this year, which gives you an idea of how unpopular 3D is becoming in the marketplace. So that's a 50-50 split. Like I said, I took the decision I'd rather see it in 2D because that's the way it was conceived. I'm sure that on an IMAX screen, it would look pretty awesome in 3D. Phil, you went to go and see Star Trek Into Darkness, didn't you, in 3D on IMAX?
3D on IMAX, new glasses, what a big difference. What a really big
IMAX
difference.
IMAX is the way. If you're going to see 3D, I think, you know, that kind of lends itself brilliantly
to
the format. But for me, I'm just over it. I don't care. It could be a brilliant film. I could come out thinking, oh, the 3D was great. But if I feel exhausted by it, then... Yeah, I'm not interested. So
yeah, well, it's good that we brought the 3D subject up because obviously there is some news since we last did a podcast. One of them is James Cameron going off on one, as normal. The other is Sky saying that they're going to stick with their 3D channel. Now you remember last week's podcast, the BBC said that they were halting their experiments with 3D, and ESPN Sports in the States is going to end at the end of the year. So interesting that Sky say they're going to stick with it, and then Cameron having to go at Hollywood about the whole 3D thing.
I think it was kind of inevitable Sky would come out and say that, to be honest, after all the negative press. Perhaps they've been listening, who knows, but the Sky's head of 3D, John Cassie, came out and said, you know, they're still big behind it, focusing on big events, nature documentaries, the stuff that people like, which is a sensible approach. They've reached the 500,000 subscriber level now, which is about a third of 3D TV owners in the country, something like that.
But they also said that they thought that it still had a future because of the glasses.
Yeah, that's just what I was guessing that too.
Which ain't going to happen.
No, which is what we touched on last week, isn't it? They seem to be sort of holding out some hope that auto stereoscopic, to give it its catchy title, is going to save 3D. But as we were saying last week, we can't see that really with the state of the technology as it is.
Well, also it'll just be hellishly expensive is the main thing, I think. I mean, I think they can probably get there technologically eventually, but it's just going to be really, really expensive. So what's the point? If no one wants it when it's cheap, who's going to pay for it through the nose?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking 10 grand.
It's a 4K panel, level. So
you're talking 10 grand entry level. That's kind of interesting. I mean, they're saying 500,000 there. I mean, I've got Sky 3D. I've never watched it. I watched it when I first got 3D TV.
Yeah, of course, you can do a lot with numbers, of course.
Never bothered with it again. And it's kind of like this whole smart TV thing, you know. Manufacturers will tell us how many smart TVs they've sold. They won't tell you is how many people have actually logged in and logged onto their smart TV networks, which would be, you know, the interesting number. So I think Sky are sticking with it just probably to put two fingers up to the BBC because they like doing that kind of thing.
Oh, they don't want to lose any subscribers either, do they?
They've probably got all their deals in place with all the Hollywood studios anyway for the 3D movies, so it's kind of a no-brainer anyway.
Yeah, I guess they may just be able to stay niche for you know, a while yet, if they're the only outlet.
Plus,
really,
they haven't got to justify it to the taxpayer or to the government, have they, the way the BBC do. They've got one channel they can leave, you know, it's a channel off out of 100, so what do they care? Their cost at this point is minimal, I should think.
So who else here has Sky 3D?
No, I don't have Sky.
No?
I haven't got Sky either.
Right, okay. So basically, if you've got 3D TV, it's 3D Blu-ray for you guys then, because the one platform that was free and available has now gone with the BBC going.
Yeah, but I mean, a bit like you, Phil, I mean, I've always been 3D Blu-ray, even when there has been BBC 3D broadcast, you know, things like we said last week, Wimbledon or stuff like that. It's just, or the Millionpics hasn't looked very good, to be honest. It's just not really been, I mean, they haven't got the infrastructure and the number of cameras and the expertise yet to deliver a really enjoyable 3D broadcast in the way that they can do in 2D. So that's one of the reasons why I think I generally avoided it in that sense.
Steve, you ever had any clients ask you to do weddings and stuff in 3D?
No, never. Absolutely never. Like I say, I mentioned it a couple of weeks back. People rarely ask for Blu-rays. I have to try and force them on them. So, I've no interest in it. I really don't see a future in it.
And I guess the other interesting angle was Cameron, that's James Cameron, not David Cameron, slagging off Hollywood.
I had to change the time for that. I did put David Cameron.
Obviously slagging off Hollywood with their use of 3D. He's telling everybody that they're all doing it wrong. Quite interesting angle that he's coming from, which is basically he wanted to get rid of the screen plane. That was his whole idea with 3D, with Avatar and so on, which was that the action moves backwards from the screen plane and not forwards towards you. So that was his thing, and he's saying that obviously directors are they're going for the cheap gags, and that's what's killing 3D at the cinema. But I think he's clutching at straws now, guys, is he not?
I don't think that's even true. I think the majority of 3D films that I've seen, the directors have been quite scared of negative parallax, and it's all been basically just behind the screen depth rather than any in-your-face forward effects. The only film I've seen recently that's really done that a lot was Sam Raimi's Oz the Great and Powerful, where he wasn't afraid to poke you in the eye. Most of them, I mean, if you look at Tron, I mean, large chunks of that I don't think even are in 3D. It's so shallow and rubbish. I think the problem is that people, a lot of the filmmakers, don't know how to shoot in 3D, don't know what they're doing, don't have a good stereographer, or being forced to by the studio. People also, a lot of them are post-production conversions rather than genuine native 3D productions. And that's the problem. It's a lack of quality content, a lack of good 3D content in the sense of well-shot 3D.
And that's exactly what Cameron was saying, isn't it, really? I mean, he was right in a lot of what he was saying. It was a little bit ironic. He said that he quoted something to the grounds of, if you spend $150 million on a movie, then, you know, it doesn't need to be in 3D. Well, you know, the word Avatar obviously comes to mind straight away there. But, yeah, I think he was
not
right.
Not really, because Avatar was conceived for 3D.
It was. But it could have looked great in 2D as well, do you not think?
But I do think, a lot of the things in that film, plot points in that film, seem to be
true,
almost
that's true.
There
that's
for the very nature of the fact it's in 3D.
A huge part of this is the back end, the visual effects, you know, support network. I mean, it doesn't just stem from the director. You know, there's hundreds, sometimes thousands of people in the background making it happen. And Hollywood's in a bit of a bad place with VFX artists at the minute, the way they sort of shift budgets around. And there was, you know, I think there's a seminar on YouTube you can see, which is kind of addressing the state of the visual effects market. And basically what it boils down to is Hollywood trying to get the best deal and not exploiting the industry, but definitely, you know, moving mass production to somewhere like Vancouver and then maybe moving it to, say, Toronto or India just to get a deal. And, you know, they're pulling the strings as well.
Yeah, there's effects houses going bust all over the place at the minute.
The guys that made Life of Pi, exactly.
Yeah, they won the Oscar for Life of Pi and they were all out of a job.
You know, for me, actually, before I'd say why I think 3D has failed completely, and I think it's down to this one issue as well as all the others, but this is the main one. Simon, you said you were 3D'd out. Why? Why do you feel 3D'd out?
Basically, because when the format first came on, I was the only one 3D enabled, and I'd done something like 70 reviews off the bat. Pretty much every release that came out, I'd done, and I just got worn out at the end of it. There was nothing new, there was nothing innovative. A lot were conversions, and I was just bored. There were no decent films. That's what it was.
Well, for me, it comes down to one thing, and that's brightness. That is the number one killer for 3D. Especially in the cinema, is brightness. As soon as you put the glasses on, you're cutting more than 50% of the light coming through the glasses, and that just kills stuff, especially if you look at something like Harry Potter or other dark movies where you're sitting in a cinema and you can't see a damn thing on the screen.
True.
And that, for me, is the biggest issue.
Yeah, because you pay your money. It should be the best example of seeing that movie. That should be the best you're ever going to see it, you know?
And, of course, you've got cinemas who are turning down the brightness of the projectors to save money.
Yeah, that never helps. If you're looking at sort of the average screen, it's meant to be 16-foot Lambert's, and it's probably not even that. And the specs for 3D is 4-foot Lambert's. on a big screen, that's really dim.
And you get charged for glasses, and you get charged for the film itself.
Well, this sort of is a money-making exercise. I mean, we said this right at the start. I mean, we wrote loads of stuff on 3D, and was it going to work, and all the rest. And at the end of the day, you could see right through it, especially with electronics manufacturers. They were in it for the quick buck. They thought they could resell us all HD TVs with 3D on it, and it backfired completely. So that's the latest on 3D stuff. And to wrap up on the movies, Simon, give us a quick roundup of what's coming up from the guys reviewing.
We have a number of Arrow films coming up. Dressed to Kill, Runaway Train, which was an Oscar winner, believe it or not. I watched that myself very recently. Terrific looking, great film. Catch the review very, very soon. Identity Thief, that's coming up. And a little known film from Alan called In the House. Now, I don't know much about that. A little French thing. Might be interesting.
On Friday, The World's End opens.
Oh, so, yeah.
Peg and Frost are back.
Well, yeah. I might have to get myself to an air-conditioned cinema on Friday. Okay, so that wraps up the movies. We'll be back in a sec with tech news. So moving on, tech news, and yet again, Apple finding themselves in some difficulty in the marketplace. Issues surrounding their attempts to trademark the iWatch name in various countries, including China. So what's the full story, Mark?
Well, it's just been an ongoing story of a struggle for Apple in China as they try and crack the world's largest market. I think it took that status from the States last year, and it's obviously where everyone wants to get in. I believe they're only, and I say only, ranked sixth in China in terms of sales for the iPhone, which is disappointing for them. It's just been a series of, I think they think they were going to waltz in and everyone would roll over, but it's not the way out east. They started off the beginning of the year, they were accused of some arrogance over their warranty policies. They were just giving 1 year in China whilst they give longer periods in other territories. I think they were branded arrogant by the government. Tim Cook came out and said, yes, we're handling China very badly, and we need to learn the way of things. As you say, the iWatch has been patented over there. And then there's always the issue of counterfeiting as well.
Also getting sued for some Chinese company had, I think they called it iRobot or something like that, and it was
Siri. Yeah, that's another thing, and that looks actually potentially problematic for them, because it looks like that technology is quite advanced from the Chinese manufacturer. And of course, if they haven't got Siri and they can't use Siri, that's going to nullify a lot of the advantage of their latest products.
Would Siri work with the Mandarin?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Siri.
It struggles with Scottish.
Yeah. Pardon? But you'd have to think they're going to spend some serious cash in getting it right.
Number 11. I'm sorry. Say that again. Number 11.
What are you saying, Phil?
Yeah, well, that's it. You know, it just doesn't understand. I want a curly whirly.
And these are all things you've tried.
Well, you know, you get bored.
Yeah, true.
So the iWatch thing, I mean, obviously, now this has become public. We know that that's the way that Apple are going. We discussed it two podcasts back about the whole smartwatch thing. The Siri thing, it's interesting. Also, news today that there was a young Chinese girl electrocuted and killed using her iPhone 5.
Yeah,
while it was plugged into the mains, and she answered a call, and allegedly she was electrocuted through the phone. Now, we don't know if this is a genuine Apple product.
She was a flight attendant, wasn't she? Then she was plugged into the mains of an aeroplane, so I don't know whether that has any bearing on things. But it's certainly the first case we've heard of that.
Because, you know, when I used to live in Hong Kong,
here we go again.
Anywhere else?
One podcast, yes.
Did you live anywhere else, Steve?
Tokyo.
Anywhere else?
And Jersey.
Right, go on then. When you were in Hong Kong.
Even when the iPhone first launched, I knew people that had almost immediately had knockoff iPhones that were made in China. And I mean, there were entire Apple stores that weren't legit. People working for them thought they worked for Apple. Yeah, it's quite common, actually. I mean, over the border in Shenzhen, from Hong Kong, where obviously most of the factories were in that part of China. I mean, just thousands and thousands of factories. And there was, you could go over the border into the city itself, and there'd be loads of products like Louis Vuitton bags and that kind of stuff. And it was all kosher. It was all, made in the factories. But then they'd get an order for 10,000, they make 11,000 and sell the other 1,000 down in Shenzhen. So it happens all the time.
quite telling that the companies that are ruling out in China are the Southeast Asian companies. I think, yeah, there's more experience of the market and the mentalities.
Yeah, but what you've seen is a lot of companies moving production out of China and back to, say, places like the US and Britain, because they're sick of there's obviously the time difference, for one thing. There's the communication issues. There's a trust issue. There's problems with quality control.
And it's not as cheap as it was either.
It's not as cheap as it used to be. The economy's starting to slow down now, and obviously wages have increased significantly in the last decade. And so they're actually finding that it's cheaper and easier and, you know, safer just to make them stuff back in the UK or in the US. So, it'd be interesting to see what happens over the next couple of years, but there's been a real move towards that, particularly with, say, higher tech stuff. It's one thing if it's, you know, a pair of shoe or a handbag, but with higher tech stuff, I think there's been a real move away from China for all those reasons.
Yeah, but it's not just Western products, though. HTC, Chinese company, one website, tech website today, carrying photographs of an almost identical knockoff model. So even the Chinese companies have been pirated.
I think it's pretty funny. I think it's kind of like that band that everyone else really, really likes but you don't like, and then you see them failing in a certain country, or an album comes out and it's rubbish. I think it's quite funny when Apple fail in a market.
I don't think so. Not necessarily failing, are they? They're just not
having it their own way, should we say.
No. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. It's interesting to watch, for sure.
And I love Apple products. So, you know, it's not like I'm an Apple hater or anything like that. I just think it's funny when, you know, the big boys wade in. And they are arrogant. You know, it's the Chinese just say, not around here, mate. Not necessarily in that.
Not around here, mate.
So it looks like Apple's not having it all their own way, although it is interesting now that the wraps, certainly in terms of patencies off on iWatch, I guess it's watch this space. Any news, Mark, on when we're likely to see the iWatch? Any rumours?
Yes, Phil, there was a report from the Financial Times today. They've good track record on picking these things up. They reckon that the iWatch is as much as 12 months away. Apple have been hiring in talent and engineers outside of their usual expertise that they've got within the company
now. From watch companies.
Yeah, from watch companies, from people who need to make remote controls. But 12 months away, which would leave them quite a long way behind. Certainly Sony and probably Google. And even Microsoft now, they're rumoured to be working on a iWatch or a Windows watch, perhaps made out of metal. So 12 months down
watch
the line.
Watch made out of metal? What will they think of next?
See-through aluminium. Transparent aluminium, I think it was.
But transparent aluminium, that's from Star Trek. There's no such thing as transparent aluminium.
80% transparent.
Held together with skyhooks.
That's what Scotty builds. They put the whales inside the spaceship.
I want one made with unobtainium.
Wasn't it one of you that was complaining about the fact that you were worried about breaking them when we were discussing it a couple of weeks ago? Oh, well, there you go. There's the answer. One made of metal. Are you sold? Yeah.
I'll replace the one I've got made of straw now, Mark.
Sundial is going out the window.
Who wears a watch nowadays anyway? You know what I mean? Mark,
I do.
I actually do wear a watch, even though I made that joke 2 weeks ago.
I do
actually have a watch.
Maybe not in this weather, but I do.
No,
like
it's
that.
It's a bit sweaty for that. But,
Just never that far away from a time source, are you? You find out the time.
Oh, really? No. Looking at three while I'm sat here right now. Yeah.
Wasn't there a phone that you could use as a watch you could use as a phone on one of your video things last year, Phil?
Yeah. That was LG. And it was more than last year, Simon. That was about four years ago.
Was it four? The one I want is the one they had in that TV series, The Gemini Man, where you pressed the button and you were invisible for 2 minutes.
Oh, no.
The whole
would be cool.
TV show was designed around the fact they introduced the digital watch.
24 months away, that one.
Is that the glasses free version?
That's the glasses free, yeah. It'll save the smartwatch industry.
So So let's move on. Let's stay with technology and gaming and crowdsourcing. It's the new big thing. Kickstarter, really making a name for itself now with lots of interest in tech, movies, games, and all sorts of things coming from the crowdsourcing company. It's also operating in the UK now. So lots of interesting stories, Mark, but you picked up on one regarding a game which has been sourced by the crowd, yet doesn't seem to be coming along very soon.
Yeah, Tim Schafer from here previously of LucasArts and various great adventure games. He asked for $400,000 to get Broken Age, I believe it's now called, off the ground. Lots of fans want to see a kind of resurgence in this genre. Lots of people very keen on Kickstarter, the democratization of gamers, you know, taking the power away from big publishing houses that were tending to go down the AAA route. And it appears that they've, even though they broke their own records, you know, they got the money. They were over 3 million, I think, at last count. But they're looking like they've run into trouble, and they're now talking about releasing it via Steam Early Access. So the first half of the game will be released, and they're hoping that will pay for the next half of the game. There are lots of kind of quotes coming from the camp about, you know, not wanting to make a small game, and the trouble is, you know, reining in, you know, all your different ideas. And I think it's just a case of perhaps the dreams broken about Kickstarter, this idea that the big bad, you know, financial men in the background and the suits who kind of crack the whip as the bad guys perhaps sometimes are needed to keep the creative minds on an even keel.
So the first thing it jumps into my head is that you give creatives $3 million and they spend most of the time down the pub drawing things on the back of fag packets, and before you know it, the money's gone. That's why you need the suits. That's why you need, you know, the businessmen there, because they're businessmen. They make money by keeping, you know, a tight ship and making sure that people hit deadlines.
Yeah, I mean, if the movie industry is anything to go by, whenever they've given a director sort of, you know, unlimited leeway to do whatever the hell he likes, it's usually gone massively over budget and been a huge disaster. Heaven's Gate springs to mind.
I find the whole Kickstarter thing just a bit cynical, especially when you've got very established names. So, someone like Tim Schafer, for example, you know, he should be able to go and get the finance privately because he's got such a long track record. So it's kind of the project that really had no place on there in the first place. I've actually done a few Kickstarter promos for companies, and you know, you see the kind of work that people put in behind the scenes, and there's businesses and ideas that really do benefit from it, and then there are projects which you think have just got no place on there.
It's definitely a great way, I think, for low budget movies and independent features, documentaries, that kind of thing, to raise the funding necessary, because things that aren't going to get financed by a large studio. Like Mark said, it's democratization of the funding process, and I think works there also. And this is, I think, where it could get really interesting. Cancelled TV shows. I mean, there's already talk about Kickstarter funding a sort of a relaunch of Veronica Mars. I know as soon as that went up, people started talking about Firefly, and Joss Whedon had to come on and say, "Look, guys, I'm a bit busy with Avengers right now. I can't really be doing a Firefly TV series, even if we could raise the funds outside of the normal networks." I think it makes it for an interesting way of, you know, getting more content out there without being at the mercy of the major studios or you know, TV networks.
I mean, it's an interesting model. You're buying in, so you get something back. There was a console. Was it the Ouya console, which was done?
Ouya.
I don't know how to say that. I say Ouya.
Ouya.
Ben Ingber from the reviews team, he purchased one, and I kind of had a nibble at him the other day asking if he'd sold it already. I think it's pretty much a doorstop in his house right now.
Right. But, I mean, the interesting thing is, though, you pay a set amount of money. Some of them do different tiers. So if you donate X amount, you get this. A little bit higher, you get a bit more. Blah, blah, blah. It seems, you know, if you believe in the project, it's something that you want to see. And of course, the people have to raise what they say that they need. If they don't raise that much, then they don't get any money whatsoever. Am I right on that one? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think some of it depends. I think Kickstarter do like that. Some of the other sites, you have the option of saying, if you don't hit your target, you give it back, and or otherwise you'll just go with what you've got, for example.
There's one on there that caught my interest, which was a documentary that this team of filmmakers want to make about the DeLorean from Back to the Future. They found the original A car and it's been fully restored for Universal. And they were going to tell the whole story about them finding that car, a couple of the B cars that were used for stunts and that kind of thing, restoring them, and then a little bit of history about how the car was built and all that. Because it's an iconic thing from iconic movie, and that's something I would be interested in watching. But then when you look at what they were actually offering you for the money that you were putting in, I mean, if you put $4,000 in, you were getting a Blu-ray, a poster that was signed by these four filmmakers who are nobodies at the end of the day because they're trying to raise funds.
Yeah.
And an invitation to the premiere at a little cinema somewhere. So for $4,000, it didn't seem like, you know, you would get an executive producer credit on the end credits.
Oh, yeah, I've already got that on Lord of the Rings.
Right. So, you know, it seems like an awful lot of money for not an awful lot in return, even though I'm interested in the subject, and I'd probably, you know, I'd buy it on Blu-ray if that was available, because I'm actually quite interested in seeing that. I think it'd be an interesting
subject. It's a prime example of a product that doesn't really need to be on there. For me, Kickstarter comes into it to its own when you've got a niche product. For example, you and I, Phil, you know, anything to do with cameras, that piques our interest. So if someone makes, you know, a accessory or something that is very niche and they need to sell maybe, you know, 10,000 units for it to be worth it, they can sell direct to the people that want it. You know, that makes sense to me. A documentary, I mean, you should really be going to a station or a broadcaster or someone, and if you've got a sound idea and a good production team behind you, you know, they'll take a good look at you.
Yeah, it's true, Steve. I recently bought a Kickstarter product, a company called Bridge, B-R-Y-D-E, make really, really nice keyboards for iPads, and they're beautiful. They're made out of aluminium. They look, I mean, you'd swear blind they were made by Apple, and they've got the same style keyboard as the MacBook Pros have got now, and it's a gorgeous little product, and that was a Kickstarter company, and I loved it.
What did you pay outright just for one unit, or did you pay
I just bought one. Yeah, no, I saw another journalist who had one at one of the trade shows, and I thought it was a laptop at first, and a MacBook Pro. I thought, what the hell's that? He goes, oh no, I've got this keyboard from a company called Bridge, and it's a beautiful little product, and you know, that's the kind of niche thing, I think, where it really does come into its own.
And they do limited runs as well, because you've only got X amount of time to jump in on something like that, so there's a little bit of, you know, exclusivity there as well, which is nice.
Yeah, I saw they were doing a wooden version of the mini keyboard.
Yeah, I saw that. Keyboard. It looks awesome, doesn't it?
but I'm a smoker. That lasts all the 5 minutes.
I'm not joking about the ring, by the way. My name is on the...
Is it you really? Or just your name?
Yeah, no, if you get your extended cutout, bung it on, any one of the three Lord of the Rings movies, go to the end of the credits, and there's thanks to the fan club members. And just after Elijah Wood, you'll see Stephen J. Wood.
Jesus Christ, he's a member.
Is that
of the
actually
fan
you?
Club.
Was that just
It cost me $100. Best $100 I've ever spent.
Oh, who did you pay $100 to?
Only you ever seen it.
Yeah, it goes on for like 20 minutes, those credits.
Who did you pay?
I saw it online or something, or in a magazine. And there
how
was
many
saying,
thousand executive producers are there then for that?
Well, basically, they must have made a fortune off of that. Must be about 4,000 names there.
Can you imagine Peter Jackson? He must have been pissed up saying, oh, let's try this and see how many mugs come and throw in some money.
That's the thing, is that everyone thinks, you know, like with the £4,000 or whatever, you know, no one's going to pay that. In fact, those are the things that actually do make money.
There was this quote,
I think it was an interview with Peter Molyneux where he was talking about it. He was saying that most of the Kickstarter funds come at the very end. So it's like with Broken Age, it made like most of that 3.2 million. There was like this sudden surge of about 700,000 in like the last, you know, week or something ridiculous. People just buying like a T-shirt or something. There's this whole kind of core group of people who literally see what products are getting near to their threshold, what products are decent, and then they just pay for that. It's a little bit like, I mean, if you look at the world of music, when Radiohead released an album for, you know, download, pay what you want, they made more on that than they did, I think, on the previous four albums.
Yeah. I thought most people paid nothing.
Well, that's the thing. Most people do.
I paid five of them.
Yeah, all it takes is for one person in 10 just to say, I'm going to pay that £100 or something, you know, something
Radiohead
so far out of whack.
Because they're massive.
Yeah, that's a fair point. By the same token, there are a lot of small acts that are more likely to see some kind of a financial return for their efforts by going down that route than they are trying to get agents and the like. Well, they've just made a cool documentary. Have you seen about the Power Glove?
The what?
Yeah.
What?
There's a documentary.
Power Glove.
Yeah,
I've got two.
Power Glove.
You
tell us something useful. Working.
See, we were all thinking it, but you had to say it.
Steve wants to know where he can donate.
Well, I know what I'm gonna donate. Where is the matter of time?
Well, we already know he's one of them. We paid 100 quid to get an executive producer thing on Lord of the Rings. I mean, that is sad, Steve. I know you do some sad things, but come on, mate.
I think it's brilliant.
Good for you.
The thing about the giving stuff away for free, that actually it does work in your favour, because if it's a good product and people like it, they usually feel compelled to come back and donate.
Yeah, it's only ever one project really going badly wrong away from everyone losing a lot of trust in it, I think. That's the thing. If you've got a huge project and suddenly that doesn't see the light of day, then I think it could be curtains for Kickstarter then.
See, I see that, but I just think that there is this kind of level of almost artistic philanthropists out there who are just willing to kind of donate a certain amount just for things, just to see if they can get made. It's kind of quite sad in the gaming sphere that most of them are kind of asking for old games to get remade and the like. But by the same token, there are loads of kind of like obscure films and the like that if someone said, right, we'll crowdsource, try and get together the money and we'll try to buy some, you know, obscure print or something that some collector's holding on to that he won't give over so a film can appear on Blu-ray or something, then I'd donate to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think cancelled TV shows, that could be really where, you know, there's enough fans out there who want something back and it got canned by the network for whatever reason, then, you know, you could see old shows suddenly coming back, you know, through crowdsourcing.
One of the biggest things at CES last year, well, actually, it was two big things at CES last year, Steve. There was the fork that tells you when you've eaten enough.
Yep.
And there was the Pebble smartwatch.
Yeah, neither of which particularly interesting to me, but
made
it on the BBC.
Yeah, but it spins and it also it measures how much you've put in your mouth and then it tells you that you've
you're
had
a fat
enough.
Bastard.
Can you override the fork?
My wife does a good job of that.
I don't know.
Honestly, who needs a fork? I know when I've eaten too much. I feel sick. I don't need a fork to tell me that.
Yeah, well, that was the lead story in the BBC, so it tells you everything you need to know. But the interesting thing was the Pebble smartwatch, and it got loads of traffic on tech sites all over the place.
That's made over 10 million now.
$10 million. So, you know, if you've got a good product and people want it.
And I think TV shows, you know, if you don't get the same creative team, it could come back at, you know, a poorer show.
You need to try and get the same creative team, you know, that's what I mean. I'm not saying you just do it with a bunch of different people and some crappy sets.
Yeah.
But if you could raise enough money to get back the original team and the original actors to do a second season or something that was cancelled in its first season. I mean, it happened with Arrested Development, of course. I mean, it was Netflix that paid for that, but they brought back a show that had been cancelled.
But I think they probably had a movie as well. Yeah, but it would all have been under the condition of as long as
everyone back. And that show was full of what people have become since massive stars. So and it's co-produced by Ron Howard. So, I mean, I'm amazed it got cancelled because it had an amazing pedigree and it was really funny. But, you know, that's the vagaries of the network system in the States.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned cancelled programs because we're going to come back to that in a second. So, Steve, we're talking about cancelled programmes, TV programmes, and how streaming companies seem to be the ideal solution at the minute for either making their own content or reviving cancelled content. Another streaming service coming to our TVs very soon, probably over the end of the summer, but available on PC and Mac now. And it's a Spanish company. They're called Wacky TV. I think that's how you pronounce it, Wacky. And their streaming service is going to be $2.99 a month. That drastically undercuts Netflix and Love Film. So, Mr. Hodge, what's the full details on this one?
Well, yeah, I think it's probably good to point out that it's $2.99 while it's in beta. So, well, that's while it's on Mac and PC only. It's going to be $5.99 just like Netflix when it launches fully later in the year. It's been a big success in Spain. It's got 600,000 subscribers. What it does differently to the likes of Netflix and Love Film is it gives you the opportunity of a subscription-based service, which you can get at the allotted content at. And then there's blockbusters available for rental and purchase, and also a catalogue of other movies and TV shows that you can purchase. So it's everything under one roof. Of course, it'll live or die by the content, and it looks quite promising. I mean, I had a quick flick through last week, and they've got Oz the Great and Powerful, Cloud Atlas, Lincoln, and they're available at $3.49 to rent, which is pretty reasonable compared to the likes of, I mean, all I can compare it to, I've got Virgin Movies at home through TiVo, and they tend to be more like $5.99 sort of premium. So it's priced well, good content. It's got a chance, definitely.
But it's just a streaming, another streaming TV thing. What makes it so different?
It's just the fact that you can have a subscription, or you can rent, and you can buy, which doesn't, that Love Film and Netflix is just purely subscription based, and you're limited to their catalogue of stuff that isn't as up to date as Wacky looks to be.
But I think what it is a precursor of things to come. I mean, you've got more and more of these catch up or streaming services are becoming available. You've got, you know, methods of buying or renting movies already from places like iTunes. How long is it before broadcast TV, you know, becomes redundant?
I think it's a long way off totally redundant. There's going to be big sporting events, but I mean, I give it 10-15 years, really.
But even sporting events, you could just stream them live.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah,
you don't have to broadcast them. I mean, people. Yeah.
It becomes redundant when they want it to. I think the BBC and Sky and everyone are in as good a position as any one of the streaming companies to roll out their own service. I mean, Sky, the second biggest ISP in the country, you know, now that's not by accident. You know, they know what they're doing there.
I think we have to accept, maybe not by 2020, as it said in one of your news stories, Mark, but I think we have to accept that the way that people watch TV is changing drastically right now.
Less than half of people in that survey that was from that story watched it on a traditional TV.
Yeah,
it was all away from the TV, phones, tablets, PCs. Yeah, that's the way it's going.
So, and give it 7 years, give it more of these streaming services. The government is promising higher speed internet is coming to at least 90% of the country by 2016 or 2017. So, I mean, you're going to have, hopefully have the infrastructure in there. People already time shift. You know, apart from Wimbledon, I can't remember the last thing I watched as it went out on air, because if it's anything that's interesting to me, I Sky Plus it. I have Netflix. I use that for catching up on stuff that I've missed. They're producing some fantastic stuff. I just wish we could get HBO in this country. Maybe Wacky TV will bring HBO stuff over to the UK. Who knows? I just see that being the future.
Yeah, you'll get up your tablet or your smartphone, and you'll go through you'll look at your screen. You'll have a list of probably channels or even dedicated program apps, and it'll just take you straight to the action. Launch it on your TV.
The problem is going to be if it all gets, you know, so disparate. You've got all these different service providers. You know, it costs a bloody fortune if you have to see, start buying a bit here and a bit there.
That's the one thing it concerns me, and that's the one thing why I think Apple have not launched a TV, an Apple TV, because things are so stretched, because you know, rights are all over the place. It's easy with music because the music industry was in a bad way. Jobs promised them money, got all the big labels under one roof, created the iTunes store, and it's been a huge success. You ain't going to do that with TV, film companies, cable companies, these streaming services are paying for their own content now. It's just becoming so divided that I honestly can't see Apple launching a TV, because they wanted everything under one roof. That was going to be their killer app. And nobody's going to be able to do that. So it is going to be stretched, broken. You're going to have to go to one place to get one thing. You're going to have to go to another place to get another thing. So unless the industry get together, and we know how bad the industry are at doing that, I think that's the way it's going to be, Steve. I think it's going to be fractured like that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, at the moment, you know, your best bet, basically, if you want something like that, is to get a Samsung product, because they currently are the only manufacturer that has iPlayer, ITV, 4OD, 5 Demand, or Demand 5, whatever it's called, plus Love Film and Netflix. So, I mean, that is the closest you can get right now to all those products under a single roof. But obviously, you'd still have to pay individually for Love Film and Netflix.
You can do that on a Skybox, though, remember.
I don't like to talk about Sky.
I just think they're best positioned out of everyone in this situation. They're
it's not quite the same thing, though, Phil, because you have to pay for Sky. I mean, you don't have to pay for any of that apart from Love Film and Netflix. Well, you had a Samsung Blu-ray player, for example.
The terrestrial stuff's free.
Well, it's free anywhere.
Well, that's what we're talking about. You were saying that's the only catch-up. No, Sky do all the catch-up services as well for the terrestrials.
Yes, but you still have to have Sky to start with.
It's 10 million people who got Sky, Steve.
Yeah, that's because there's 10 million idiots in this country.
Just because you live in a listed building, you kind of get a satellite dish on the side. You know, you don't need to take it out on the rest of us. Let's move over to Botwright. I mean, he lives in a listed building. That says everything you need to know about Steve. Mr. Botwright, let's talk about games, because Love Film did do games, game rentals, but they're phasing that out now, something which you discussed on the Games podcast. Where does the gaming side of things come in on this? I mean, obviously you get gaming apps on different platforms at the minute, but where do you see that developing?
There's a chance that perhaps this is, as Steve suggested, perhaps a kind of fallout from the Xbox One policies, a business that thought that perhaps it wouldn't be able to carry on in the rental sector. But you're also seeing an increasing amount of games having online passes, and so therefore you're actually getting half a game if you're renting it. You know, mail costs are going up as well, and there are a few businesses in the sector, and I think a couple of them do it very well, and I think perhaps Love Film just found it a little bit hard going, and perhaps it's best that they just concentrate on movies.
Now, we did see some streaming game services. Steve, you went to the thing at Earl's Court, was it last year or the year before?
It was the year before now, yeah. It's
yeah, actually, and there was that streaming game service, and I guess that's disappeared off the face of the planet, has it?
No, I think it is still about. It very nearly disappeared into the oblivion, but it was given a last-minute stay of execution, and Sony bought up Gaikai as well, which could end up being a big part of the new PlayStation 4 service. I think the technology is really, really clever. I mean, it's really, really pushing the whole, you know, way we could play games forward. I think maybe it was a little bit too soon back then. I don't know. I guess it goes to show whether you can make subscriptions for gaming a viable thing. You know, we already sort of accept the fact that we pay for Live and PlayStation Plus, so they're going to start rolling more games into that. And, you know, maybe that genuinely is the future, because I guess there's less overhead in hardware costs as well. So it will certainly be there in years to come, that's for sure.
It's an interesting subject matter. We are no doubt going to come back to this in the weeks ahead as these services develop, as we get more coming in. And I guess competition has to be a good thing moving forward. So if there's more companies like this, Wacky TV, who start launching their own streaming service, we might start to see some amalgamation. We might see start to see takeovers, and then the content being available maybe just on a couple of platforms in the future. I mean, that's usually the way that these things work. You get lots of startups, and then finally they all get eaten up by the big companies out there. So we'll just have to wait and see.
I'm torn. I think I'm going to expand my package with Sky this
year. Can you get those channels?
Yeah.
Apparently you can.
You can put on your power glove and expand your package to your heart.
To wrap up on the podcast this week, we're going to go to Mark. Some big gameplay trailers now coming out for some of the biggest anticipated titles of the year. Tell us about them.
Yeah, well, I suppose the biggie would be Grand Theft Auto 5 gameplay trailer. Shows a little bit of the character switching that a lot of people wanted to see, as well as, you know, we're getting news about how the multiplayer is going to work. And, yeah, it's going to be perhaps the big threat to the next-gen consoles coming out, because there's going to be seemingly hundreds of hours worth of content in there. And so if you were considering dropping either £40 on a new game or £400 on a new console, I think they're pretty much quids in.
Is it not going to come out on PS4? Then?
They've not announced it, but you can bet that it will. Well, they know it'll dilute sales if they tell them it's coming out on the next gen console.
I wouldn't expect it straight away. I'd expect there to be perhaps 6 months, 18 months,
yeah,
at least before that, you know, and the PC gets any kind of release. So, that, I mean, they want to milk the biggest market, don't they? They don't want anyone thinking to themselves, well, I'll put off buying it now. I'll buy it when I get a new console. And then when they do buy a new console, there's something else out. They want to hit that kind of holiday season crowd right now. And you're at the end of a console lifespan when you've got the biggest install base.
You can probably bet that Sony and Microsoft will be vying for a term of exclusivity on the new consoles. I would have thought there'd be big money for Rockstar if they were going to exclusive for, say, 12-month period or something on the Xbox One or PS4.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I thought maybe the shine would have come off it by then, because next gen's going to have so many big hitters. Mm-hmm. I think it'd be a very difficult one to get right if they do get it right. But you can't rule anything out, I guess.
Yeah, I'd say Game of the Year edition, something like that, with all the downloadable content or whatever it is that will come out in the, you know, 9 months afterwards. That's the way to kind of get people on board, because by that time the game's come down in price, people will think, well, it might cost £20 to get all of the download content, or I could buy it again on a looking shiny on a new console.
Yeah.
We've all done it.
Yeah, sadly.
Unfortunately true.
It did look awesome. And the fact that you can play things like tennis and golf within the game.
That's always been the beauty of those games.
Same, isn't it? Just this totally immersive world.
Get laid in the game. I think that's got to be a first.
Using a power glove, eh?
That's not a first. We've had the hot coffee mod.
Although I think you could have a threesome in Fable. In fact, I think you could have an orgy in Fable, actually.
Well, what's the definition of an orgy then? So three, more than three.
You could basically just go and
four or, invite, four or more.
You could invite the whole village back to your...
I'm sure I'd want a village idiots back at my place.
Your room at the inn.
Steve, what you normally find is if you can't find a village idiot, it's usually you.
Do they have village idiots in Hong Kong?
I actually worked for a German bank who were based in Dusseldorf, and I found out that Dusseldorf in English is town of idiots. Anyway, sorry, Mad Max trailer looked pretty good.
Oh, yeah, yes.
I mean, obviously, that's tying in with the new movie, Mad Max Fury Road, which they're shooting at the moment. I think it's coming out next year with, I believe, Tom Hardy in the part of Max. Because obviously, Mel's getting on a bit now, and also his bonkers. So,
he's aging never stopped anyone.
Misogynistic, drunk.
No, he's not aging, and he's not you know, bonkers. He's now Scottish. He tried to be Scottish in Braveheart, and it nearly worked. But look at him now. Just look at him now. He is the perfect Scotsman.
Anyway, obviously, so there's a new Mad Max film coming out, and to tie in with that, they've obviously got a game, which I have to say looked really good in the trailer.
I haven't seen the trailer. What kind of game?
Mark sent you a link before this podcast.
Yeah, I haven't watched it though.
So you're on time, but you're not
preparation for the podcast.
You know, as a producer, Steve, you should be really cracking the whip and getting these boys to be, you know, at least know what they're talking about.
I'm just glad they turn up.
No, but I mean, it's coming from Avalanche, who did, you know, did Just Cause games, so you know they know how to make a decent open world game. My only kind of concern, because I mean, it showed all the kind of violence that you'd want from it, vehicular combat and the like, and he's snapping arms and necks, and it had a great tune as well to the trailer, which always helps. But I mean, the Just Cause games were very much known for, you know, sandbox fun, and it was quite a populated, lush environment. Just this kind of, I wonder whether post-apocalyptic Australia might be just a little bit too desolate, whether you're actually going to want to explore roads that, you know, ride on straight off into the sunset for, you know, 100 miles.
I thought that's how Australia was at the minute.
Yeah, you wouldn't notice a difference after an apocalypse, basically.
Big hello to everyone down under, by the way.
To our Australian listeners.
No, but it does look quite kind of desolate, so I just wonder how they'll manage to kind of get around that sense of isolation, or whether they'll actually kind of play to it.
I was surprised it was deemed worthy of a remake and a new game. I never thought it was that great a series. I know they made, what was it, three movies, but...
Hang on a minute, Steve, I'm sorry. The Road Warrior is one of the best films ever made.
The original, the first one.
No, the second one. Mad Max 2, but it's called The Road Warrior in the States. But that is a work of pure genius.
I haven't seen it in a long, long time, so yeah, maybe I should dig it out.
Brilliant. They just bought out a box set, all three
it's
movies.
It's on Blu-ray, is it? Blu-ray. Okay.
Yeah. You get it for about £20. It's worth getting because they are. I mean, even the third one's not bad. It's not great, but it's the second one is just a masterpiece.
See, I preferred the first. The second's just got a little bit too much kind of Duran Duran hairspray kind of thing.
No, they copied that. You can't blame Matt Road Warrior for Duran Duran copying the film. Well,
every crap hairstyle in the 80s copied Mad Max 2, did they?
Yes. The ripped leather stuff was definitely what I didn't realize until I watched it recently was how camp it is. I didn't realize until I watched it. I thought, hang on a minute, I thought it was like Hard Blokes and Leather.
The buff men in leather might have a little bit of a side to them, shall we say.
Yeah, there was a whole subtext that was completely missing. I completely missed until recently. I thought, hang on a minute.
Yeah, but a lot of 80s movies turned into that. I mean, Top Gun being the prime example.
Steve could be my wingman anytime.
Yeah, that's the line.
Steve could be Goose and Phil could be Maverick.
The only thing I have in common with Tom Cruise is my height.
Well, there you go. You'll be put next industry party.
I do currently have Anthony Edwards' hairline.
So sadly, that's it for the AV Forums podcast this week. Thanks very much for listening. We really need to go now because, as we said at the start of the podcast, it is hot and I think we're all melting here. time to go and cool down. So thanks again for listening. My thanks also to Mark Hodgkinson.
Oh, thanks.
Mark Botwright.
Cheers, Phil.
Steve Withers.
Bonsoir.
Steve Hill.
Thanks. See you later.
And Simon Crust.
It's been hot and sticky.
And not in a good way.
Don't forget you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, bookmark avforums.com for the latest reviews, news and video, and why not leave us a rating on iTunes if you enjoyed the show and made it to the end. I'm Phil Hinton, thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you again next Wednesday.